We're looking at the damage of domestic violence. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're getting a glimpse into the lives of the abused, the abusers, and the survivors with an author who's studied domestic violence for most of a decade and interviewed hundreds of people. Family violence sends women and children into shelters, into homelessness, into emergency rooms, and the ripple effect of that home life trauma can spill over generations. So we're looking deeply at the life cycle and what love has to do with it. And this hour is difficult, but it's important to have this discussion. So please take stock and use your discretion. How has domestic violence touched your life? What do you wish people knew about this issue? And how can a community help domestic violence victims? The number is 800-642-1234. You can join us at any point in this hour. Rachel Louise Snyder is a journalist. She's an associate professor in the Department of Literature at American University. Her latest book that we're exploring today is called No Visible Bruises: What We Don't Know About Domestic Violence Can Kill Us. Rachel, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
So you share in the book, you have this aha moment in which domestic violence really comes into focus for you as part of your reporting, and that led you to your work on this being much more fuller and consuming of your life. When did you realize that there was much more going on here than you realized?
Gosh, you know, I feel like it was in some ways a slow awakening, and then also like just exactly what you said, an aha moment. I mean, domestic violence had been a part of every story I had done kind of out in the world for 20 years, you know, stories of women in prison for love crimes in Kabul and, you know, child brides in Niger and India and Romania and all over the place. And it was just a backdrop of all of those stories. But it wasn't until I came back to the States and I met a woman working on domestic violence homicide prevention, which seemed like an impossible combination of words. Like, how can you prevent homicide, you know? Mm. And she very patiently sort of talked to me and gave me the lay of the land. And I realized, good Lord, we don't have a book on this. We don't have, I mean, we have lots of academic work and self-help books and memoirs, but like this isn't part of any kind of national discussion in the way that other social issues are, like poverty or homelessness or mental illness or whatever, you know? And so the more I researched, the more I realized our misunderstandings were really, all-encompassing around domestic violence.
How all-encompassing? What do we know about the numbers? I mean, the CDC says that intimate partner violence affects millions of Americans, but do we truly understand just how many people aren't counted?
I don't think we do because, for example, in the FBI's homicide reporting, those homicide reports from jurisdictions are voluntary. So there are entire areas that just have never participated, like Miami, for example, doesn't participate. Rockford, Illinois, not that far from you, doesn't participate or hasn't in recent years. So there are large parts of the population that don't participate. And that doesn't include many Native American communities. It doesn't include many immigrant communities. So the numbers that we have are, even as shocking as they are woefully understated. And in fact, since 2017, the numbers of domestic violence homicides in this country have risen by 33%.
Mm. How does domestic violence have a role in other things that we grapple with in areas like education and health and racial equity?
Oh my gosh. That's such a hard question and I'm glad you asked it. I try to address it in the book a little bit, but it really is the starting point for so many inequities. I mean, you talk about, for example, education and somebody, a child who is in a domestic violence situation at home, has cognitive delays because of the violence they're witnessing. There's a research now that points to the neural markings of domestic violence victims as being equal to that of prisoners of war. So, you know, you just can't function in a way where you have agency in your life and you're able to make good decisions and all that stuff, and you're able to learn and you know, hold down a job. You just in some of these extreme cases, I mean, I'm not talking necessarily about low level kind of violence, right? I'm talking about more extreme cases, but that those extreme cases are at least 10% of all domestic violence in this country. And so until we address domestic violence, we're not really going to be fully able to address homelessness, poverty, you know, education. I mean, domestic violence accounts for more than half of all homeless women in the U.S., for example. More than half of all mass shootings in the U.S. are domestic violence, in fact. Not that they predict domestic violence, but they are domestic violence.
It permeates so many areas. Talking with Rachel Louise Snyder, she's author of No Visible Bruises, What We Don't Know About Domestic Violence Can Kill Us. And as we have this conversation, we want to hear from you. How has domestic violence touched your family? Have you lost a loved one to domestic violence? What have you learned about the resources and support needed? Let us know at 800-642-1234. Tweet us WPR Mornings. Rachel, how has the way we treat domestic violence evolved when it comes to policy in the last century in the U.S.? And I know that's huge and century is a long time, but is are there some moments that we should take stock of?
Well, we believed that it was a husband's right to beat his spouse for most of this country's history, and in fact, around the world. We didn't have a federal law against spousal abuse in the United States until 1984. There were some states that had some early laws, like Mississippi, in fact, had a statute against spousal beating in the 19th century, but it was rarely enforced. And there was no federal law until 1984, you know, 20 years after the Civil War. So when you think about domestic violence in the long view, I think your attitude would be, well, gosh, we've made great strides since 1984. And yet it's shocking to think that is so many of our lifetimes, right? I mean, I was in high school in 1984. So in that regard, we really haven't done much. And our answer has been to just build shelters and build shelters. And it's really only recent, the last 20 years or so, that we are beginning to see that shelters, although they're necessary and people who work in shelters are sort of doing God's work, are an abysmal solution. You're taking a victim out of his or her community. You're taking the children out of the community. So if your children play sports, for example, or they're in the school play, they can't do that. They're living with other traumatized victims. It's very temporary. Normally you can't bring pets. You can't care for, you know, aging parents if you're in a shelter. And from a symbolic perspective, it's taking something which has historically been considered a private issue and up to the purview of the man of the house, and just shifting it to a different private area. You know, like I always say, like, think about if your house was burgled and they took everything that was meaningful to you and you called the police and the police came and said, my God, I'm so sorry this happened to you. This is terrible. Well, we're going to have to take you out of this house and put you in a shelter with other people who've been burgled, and your burglar gets to live here. I mean, that is essentially how we have treated domestic violence, even in the last 50 years. And so, so that needs to change as well.
We're talking with author Rachel Louise Snyder on our side here. The book is No Visible Bruises, Your Space for Your Story Involving Domestic Violence, at 800-642-1234. We'll get back to this hour's conversation in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and this is hard to talk about, so pervasive. We're looking more closely at domestic violence in our country and here in our communities across Wisconsin. This is sensitive, so please take care. Throughout much of the 1900s, as we've been talking about, domestic violence remained hidden. Victims or survivors often endured physical and emotional abuse and silence out of fear of retaliation. And Congress then held hearings in the early 80s to figure out the scope of the problem to say, hey, what do we do about this? And that's where we saw the passage of the Family Violence Prevention and Services Act in 1984, which we've been talking about, helped open shelters and fund some victim resources. There's a line for you at 800-642-1234. Survivors, when you heard the question about why victims don't leave, what goes through your head? How is this and the way domestic violence is sometimes talked about problematic to you? Call in, tweet us, WPR Mornings. Rachel Louise Snyder stays with us, and her new book is called No Visible Bruises, What We Don't Know About Domestic Violence Can Kill Us. Let us go to the phones now with Melinda joining us from Black River Falls. Hi, Melinda.
Hello.
What's on your mind?
I'd like to kind of take it a step further from what she was talking about when the victim actually has to leave their home. When I left my home, I went to a shelter. He ultimately ended up finding me at that shelter, and they transferred me to another location. But basically, he got to stay in the family home. And so when we finally got to the point of getting the divorce and getting the child custody issues figured out, he had the marital home, and that was used against me. And he ended up being able to keep the house because he was the one that was living there. I lost my community. My kids lost their school. And it was just a roller coaster from that point. Even though there was documentation, even though there were medical reports, police reports, and that there was a history of this going through therapy, I still ended up being the one that got victimized again.
And you lost the equity in the home as well. You were starting from scratch.
Yes. Yes, very, very much so.
Rachel, what are your insights here?
Yeah, Melinda, I'm so sorry that happened to you. And that this speaks to a real crisis in the courts today. And I am hearing this story. I am doing readings all over the country from coast to coast. And I hear this story again and again and again. And it's so disheartening. And, you know, it is a re-victimization. There are, I talk about this a little bit in the book. There are communities where just the smallest changes have enabled victims to stay in their homes, and they've put protections around them and held abusers for longer. Even a matter of hours is helpful, in fact. There are numerous examples of people going into shelters, primarily women, in which their abusers are able to find out where they are. There was a woman in Massachusetts who was a cable installer. And so he told her that he knew every shelter in New England, and she believed him. So Melinda is speaking to a real crisis in this country. And I think it's one of the reasons that we need to be working together to keep people out of shelters. We don't need to be building more shelters. And in fact, to me, our resources should really go toward trying to stop the violence in the first place and address why somebody is violent. I mean, I think it's time to stop asking the question, why doesn't she just leave, and start asking the question, why is he hitting her?
Melinda, how is life for you today, may we ask?
I've moved past that. It's been over 10 years. I'm in a wonderful relationship where there's not any of this. And I work kind of in a unique position where I work with men in a prison system. And I also know that this is not a one-sided story. I've experienced this from a female perspective, but I've also listened to, you know, several men throughout the course of my years in my history working in what I do. And this is a both-sided story. So, you know, hopefully some laws can just get put in place and some different things being put in place to help both sides.
Melinda, thank you so much for calling in this morning. Rachel, in 2002, it was the opening of the first Family Justice Center. What's been the impact of Family Justice Centers? What are they?
Family Justice Center is sort of one-stop shopping for victims of domestic violence. So they are co-locating all kinds of resources. So it might be the police, you might have advocates, you might have prosecutors, all in the same building. And it enables victims to not have to sort of tell and retell their story over and over. I've been in family justice centers where they even have, for example, like a free clothing, secondhand clothing kind of shop where people can get, clothes for job interviews if they need those or whatever. There's some childcare options in many of them, or children and family services have resources there. So they've been incredible in the communities where that they've been able to put them together. They can be expensive and difficult to put into a community to sort of get all those partners under one roof. But they're now operating in, I think several dozen countries. We have them in every state in the country. And they've been fantastic.
How was Nicole Brown Simpson a part of this story and a part of your book? What effect did that have on society?
Nicole Brown Simpson's, homicide was really, in some ways, the first national discussion we had about domestic violence. There was a Time magazine cover a little earlier in the 80s. I think her name was Greta. I'm forgetting her name. Of a picture of a battered woman, and that caused a ripple effect. But it really was Nicole Brown Simpson killing, where people suddenly said, oh my God, if it can happen to someone who is beautiful and wealthy and, you know, famous, it could happen to anybody. And so what I heard from advocates was that suddenly resources for domestic violence from state to state were run alongside articles about Nicole Brown Simpson. And so it really catalyzed the conversation in some way. It came right before the passage of the Violence Against Women Act, which was passed in 94, I believe. So I think it put some wings under that act. But we really haven't followed through. I mean, we had this opportunity, and that was in the mid 90s, and we really haven't progressed in our understanding since then, like as a country.
What do you think? Why is that? Why are we at a standstill?
Well, I think that, I think that in many areas it's still seen as a private issue. I think there are a lot of communities where there is this traditional hierarchy of gender that is still at play, where the man is believed to be the head of the household and the woman is subservient. I mean, I grew up in a house like that in Illinois, not far from where many of your listeners might be. So I think those all lend to that. And I think it just hasn't been on the radar as in terms of policy. The Violence Against Women Act has to be reauthorized every 5 years. It has been passed in the House. It is now just lagging in the Senate. It should be completely apolitical to protect the citizens of this country. And yet it has not passed the Senate.
Rachel, you dedicate your book to your stepmother and her stories. And your author's note at the end of the book is remarkable. What was it that your stepmother brought to your work on this?
Yeah, that was really quite a moment in my life. My stepmother passed away during the writing of this book in September of 2017, and she went into hospice and was in hospice for almost 2 months. And while she was in hospice, I was flying back and forth. They live in Arizona to help my dad take care of her. And I learned that she had been the victim of domestic violence in her first marriage. And in fact, that he had held a gun to her head. I mean, really these significant signs of dangerousness. And she had been my stepmother for 38 years. And I had no idea. I mean, I was just blown away. She knew I was researching domestic violence. I was writing about it for the New Yorker, and she never said a word. And, I was able to tell her before she died that I was going to dedicate the book to her. And, she didn't want to talk about those stories on her deathbed, but it was, I just thought if she can't tell me, someone who is, you know, an expert in domestic violence, what does it say about the sort of secrecy and shame around this issue? And, the morning she died, I'm the one who found her. I was out in the living room talking with my dad. I went into the bedroom And I saw that she had passed somewhere in that last half hour. And I called him in, and he immediately began sobbing, as anybody would when their wife or spouse of 38 years dies. And within a minute of him crying, we're both crying, he is apologizing for not being stronger because he's crying. And it just felt like there it was in my own home, that the sort of gendered belief that it weakens a man to cry, and that there's so much shame in a woman coming forward. And it really like blew me away.
The book is No Visible Bruises. Rachel Louise Snyder stays with us. You can join in with your questions, your experiences, your ideas on how to break the cycle of violence. 800-642-1234. Stay with us. A news update is next here on the Ideas Network. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The conversation this hour is all about domestic violence, and so if you're just joining us, please know that this is a sensitive conversation, and do take care. Author Rachel Louise Snyder writes that most domestic violence victims are strangled at some point during the course of an abusive relationship, often repeatedly for years. And she cites this study last year in the American Journal of Preventive Medicine. Estimated lifetime cost for survivors of domestic violence is over $100,000 for female survivors, over $20,000 for male survivors. And that's in 2014 dollars, based on 43 million adults with a history of domestic violence. The book is No Visible Bruises. Your insights, your questions this hour, they're welcome at 800-642-1234. How has domestic violence affected your community, your family? What message do you want to pass on? What changes do you want to see enacted? And Rachel Louise Snyder stays with us. Rachel, let's flesh this out a little bit more, given what you know in your work. What do we know about why victims continue to stay?
Well, they don't is the simple answer. We just don't know what staying or leaving looks like. So in my book, for example, I talk about a young woman named Michelle Monson Mosier, who was taking very subtle but definite steps to leave. She was married to a man who went and got a rattlesnake and kept it in a cage in their home and threatened to put it in bed with her or in the shower with her if she didn't comply with whatever his demands were. He had isolated her from family and friends. He wouldn't let her have people over. He didn't like it if she talked to her family members. So she had, for example, put their house in her name. The house was owned by her father, and she had secretly had her father transfer it to her name. She was taking nursing classes at college so that she could someday get a job to support her children. So she was putting things in place to be able to leave, and she was making long-term decisions for her future. And he killed her two children, and killed himself. That is not at all an unusual scenario. Leaving is a process, not an event. And it's really our misunderstanding. And then, you know, the other side of this is, like, what other crime do we put the impetus for change on the victim? Right? Like, you're the victim of a crime. I mean, your caller, Melinda, was a perfect example of that. She's the victim of domestic abuse. She's the one who has to leave. She loses her house. I mean, this is not an unusual scenario in this country, and it's one of the ways in which our attempts to address it have just been so, so wrongheaded.
Let's bring in Jesse now, joining us from Antigo. Hi, Jesse.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
I was just calling in to maybe add a comment about, you know, possibly helping to break the cycle. I was always fortunate enough that I had two extremely strong women, my mother and my grandmother, that encouraged me to make sure I finish my education, go on to get a higher education, and hopefully then I would not ever find myself in a scenario where I was maybe dependent because it seems like sometimes people are put in this scenario due to the fact that they're dependent maybe upon the income or the housing situation. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. I guess my input was, you know, just making sure and trying to encourage people to go on and reach their fullest potential, and hopefully they wouldn't find themselves in the scenario to be dependent upon another. Well, so if they wanted to walk away, they could.
Yeah, Jesse, mm-hmm. what do we know, Rachel, about education level and independence?
Well, I mean, I think Jesse is right, is that in that, you know, financial independence is definitely an issue in a lot of these relationships. The woman in Montana, for example, her husband would not let her work outside the home. She asked over and over. But it's also equally true that domestic violence runs across the gamut of, you know, socioeconomics, race, class. There's a woman that I spent over a year interviewing. She had a master's in social work. She came from a middle-class family, and her husband used to throw golf balls at her face as she drove down the highway. He would break CDs in half and threaten to slit her throat with them. He held her up against the heating pipes in their apartment in New York. They lived in the Upper East Side of Manhattan. So, and she had a job the whole time. She eventually was able to break free of him, but only because she was put in a kind of witness protection program, where her mail was delivered by private courier. She lived in a secret location. He was put on GPS. She got a lifetime restraining order against him. This is a really extreme example, but, you know, it's not always, education is good. And I totally agree with Jesse's grandmother and her mother and herself, but it's not always, that's not always foolproof. And we need to make space for the people who lie outside the stereotype of what we think of when we think of victim and perpetrator.
Let's bring in Sam now in Milwaukee with thoughts on this. Hi, Sam.
Good morning.
What would you like to add?
Just that, like you were saying before, you know, we have to find ways for women to stay where they're at instead of persecuting them. I had run several times more than 25 years ago, and he found me every time because in the community I was in, everybody knew where the shelters were. It wasn't hard to find me, and mm-hmm. they just lay in wait until you have to come out sometime. Mm-hmm. And each time he did, you know, I would go somewhere else. Eventually, I ran to family he did not know I had, quite a ways away from where I live. And it was just a complete nightmare. My whole life was disrupted because of him, and I had no protection. He did go to prison eventually, but not because of this, but because he committed armed robbery, and I moved on with my life. After he was released, actually, well, he wasn't even released yet. While he was still in prison, he was given the job of driving inmates to different job sites, and he would stalk me from the prison van. He would sit outside my house, and even then, I couldn't do anything because the police said, well, what are we supposed to do? He's not doing anything. Mm-hmm. It was just, you know, incomprehensible, and, you know, it's been 25 years, and we still don't have much better resources for women than run and hide.
Sam, thank you for bringing this to the table. And so Sam really had to be on the run all the time mm-hmm. for years.
Right, right. This is it. I mean, we say, like, again, with the story of Michelle and the snake, people offered her, you know, her mother-in-law said, go to my sister's house in Arizona. And Michelle said, he's going to find me there. He's going to call the police and accuse me of kidnapping our children. I mean, you know, where am I supposed to go on this earth? And Sam is absolutely right. And, you know, the thing about stalking is we've tightened our stalking laws in the last 25 years, thankfully, but stalking is still not seen as the threat it is. And I can't remember the exact statistic, but it's in my book. I think it's something like 80% of domestic violence homicide victims were stalked in the year prior to their death. And so we need to take stalking seriously. We need to have a national database of stalking, because if someone stalks someone in Minnesota and then they move to Wisconsin, those states don't necessarily communicate that someone has this history. So Sam brings up an incredibly important point, and we do need to be better. We need to build protections around these victims. We need to have perpetrators on GPS. We need to have tracking for them. And it's all doable, and it's not that expensive. It's certainly not as expensive as homicide investigations and healthcare costs associated with domestic violence. I mean, it's cheaper. It's cheaper in the long run.
What about the cities that build these shelters and make them in undisclosed locations and try to keep them absolutely private? Does that work?
Well, I mean, you know, your caller, Sam, is correct. I mean, first of all, even the ones that are undisclosed are not that hard to find. I mean, if you're in a neighborhood where there's a shelter, you kind of know. You kind of know because there's cameras outside and there's, you know, there's a lot of security. And that just doesn't exist in a normal, like, you know, home in a neighborhood. So that's one sort of giveaway. But also just you're housing traumatized people with other traumatized people. You have a situation where, as Sam said, she was found. Well, that compromises the safety of other people in that same environment. So while, again, I say that shelters are necessary, I don't think shelters are where we should be putting our resources. I think we need to be putting our resources into trying to stop the violence from happening, trying to give abusers alternative behaviors, alternative skill sets, doing more research on what works and what doesn't to make somebody nonviolent. And also you're taking someone out of their community, out of their home. You're taking someone away from what is familiar. They just seem inherently unfair to me.
We're talking about domestic violence and where we go from here to try to deal with the pervasiveness. In 1964, California opened a shelter for female victims, and Minnesota and Maine are generally credited with the first shelters devoted to battered women. The book we're talking about is called No Visible Bruises, and author Rachel Louise Snyder stays with us. And as we look at policies and systems and programs, you can join in with your insights and your experiences. 800-642-1234. Advocates and policymakers, what is on your mind about this? What do you hear from the people you serve? What do you need to see in order to achieve success in helping people? And what do you need to help in saving lives? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We'll be back to this hour's discussion in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about domestic violence. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here as we discuss a difficult issue. The book is called No Visible Bruises, and author Rachel Louise Snyder writes that she sees hope. She says, I look around to my male friends, my colleagues, my brothers, my friends' husbands, and I see allies everywhere. I see men who care. And we want to hear from you on that. What is your role to prevent domestic violence? Join in at 800-642-1234. Rachel, I can't believe I did find the word hope in your book. I found it to be like a mini miracle.
This part of me that is like, yes, thank you. That this is hopeful to me that we are acknowledging this. Like, this is actually part of making space for men to come forward, for victims who are LGBTQ, for anyone who's like not heteronormative. Like, I actually see those people who are yelling at me on Twitter as a positive, as a sign that like, we're having this conversation. I mean, here I am talking to Wisconsin Public Radio. I am a fellow Midwesterner. I do not think this conversation would have happened 5 years ago. This very meta moment to me is hopeful. Like, we are starting a national conversation again, and whether it's spurred by my book or whether it's spurred by something else, I don't care what spurs it. Mm. But like, to me, it's hopeful that we're having it. Of course, it's devastating to know that that domestic violence homicides are up since 2017. But I think I feel like that it might be retaliatory violence against the power of this movement, the power of us having these conversations and being able to say, like, you know what? We're not going to have this in silence anymore. We're not going to stand for this.
Let's bring in Kevin now, joining us from Janesville. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, good morning. I'd like to bring up a thought as a teacher myself at the middle school level in particular. I see children starting their relationship building and thinking about being couples. We're already teaching health education. Why can't we include behavioral health and teaching healthy relationships and behaviors to middle schoolers as they're exploring this part of their life and building these future relationships? Maybe we can head off some of these problems if they already know, hey, this person's not good for me.
Kevin perhaps brings up the public health aspect of this as well.
Yeah, yeah. Kevin, you can't see me, but I'm like cheering for you right now. I'm like, yes, Kevin, yes. Because, yeah, I mean, I'm the parent of a middle schooler. And that's what the research is saying now, is that we need to start this education when kids are 11, 12, 13 years old. I've seen it. I've seen, you know, I live in Washington, D.C., probably the most politically progressive place in the country. And I've seen it in my own daughter's school, just that the gendered kind of norms that are being established in kids this young. And I could not agree more with Kevin that we need to say to young girls, no, it's not okay that he isolates you from your friends. We need to say to young boys, like, it's not okay to ask her to do X, Y, and Z. It's like, none of this is okay. And I think this is where, again, along with the roots of violence and trying to stop violence at its core, I think to break this cycle of violence, education needs to start with exactly the age that Kevin is talking about.
And we have less than a minute left, but you have had to look abusers squarely in the eye and take down their stories, and you've absorbed traumatic accounts over and over and over. How do you carry the weight of this violence?
Yeah, well, I did have to take a year off in 2014 and 15. I had a kind of a breakdown where I just could not listen to any more stories. I took a year off. I wrote a memoir. I painted. I worked out. I read a lot. So some of it is just stepping away when I need to step away. But I also am, you know, I speak the language of empathy, and I think badwers all have stories, as your caller Sam said. I think her name was Sam. You know, I've listened to stories of men in prison, and 80% of them, something like 80%, have sexual assault or domestic violence in their own backgrounds and their own childhoods. And that is important information. It doesn't excuse their behavior, but it contextualizes us, and it gives us as a society a plan going forward.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Rachel Louise Snyder is a journalist, associate professor at American University, and her new book is titled No Visible Bruises, What We Don't Know About Domestic Violence Can Kill Us. We have links, phone numbers, resources at WPR.org on the Morning Show page. Wisconsin's drinking culture stands out from much of the nation, and it comes at a cost. On the last day of WPR's series High Tolerance, Kyla Calvert-Mason looks at the financial impacts of the state's unique relationship with alcohol.
On a Friday late in March, a dozen or so people were waiting for afternoon proceedings to begin in courtroom 615 in the Milwaukee County Circuit Courthouse. Nearly all of the defendants that afternoon faced charges related to drinking. As Judge David Borowski began hearing cases, the price tag climbed.
I'm going to impose the mandatory minimum fine of $350 plus costs, fees, 50 days in the House of Corrections, drug and alcohol evaluation, and any and all appropriate
90
days in the House of Corrections.
$350,
I'll make that inclusive of costs.
For one man, the costs of his second drunk driving offense were much higher than he'd expected. His employer didn't complete the steps for work release during his jail sentence, and he lost his job.
In his mind, he was very proud of the job.
His attorney, Robert Gordon, explained he was able to find another job.
He works substantially less hours. He was, when I last was able to chat with him, he was getting about 20 hours a week. And he was only making $10 and change there.
Researchers estimated excessive drinking cost Wisconsin and its residents $6.8 billion in 2012. The report looked at criminal justice, health care, vehicle crashes, and lost worker productivity. Scott, whose last name we aren't using to protect his privacy, is a man who knows these costs well. He says he's been sober for 5 or 6 years with the support of Alcoholics Anonymous. The financial toll drinking took on his life didn't end with the costs for his 4 drunk driving offenses, but those were significant.
Attorney's on a $5,000 retainer, for starters.
His last fine was $800, and he remembers the weekly fee during his sentence was about $250. But there were also costs for him that wouldn't be captured in that $6.8 billion estimate. He says he'd buy things he didn't need when drinking.
Like a rifle or something for hunting or something. You already got one, but you want another one, stuff like that. You want to kind of impress your other people as well as yourself.
The costs that were captured have likely changed, too. Adjusting for inflation would bring the 2012 estimate up to $7.4 billion in 2018 dollars. Jeremy Bray heads the economics department at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro. He says an increase in early deaths is one thing that could drive up the financial toll.
One of the biggest costs in those social cost estimators is lost productivity. And most of that is driven by premature death, drunk driving fatalities, alcohol poisoning fatalities.
State data shows all alcohol-related deaths rose from just over 1,500 in 2011 to more than 2,000 in 2015. Deaths from alcohol-related falls, poisonings, and suicides all rose over that period. But Wisconsin is not only known for its drinking. It's also known for its beer making. National industry groups put the economic impact of beer at $9 billion in Wisconsin in 2018. But the state may not have to choose between a culture that celebrates brewing and lowering the costs of excessive drinking. Alcohol is one of 6 areas the Department of Health Services is focusing on in a campaign to improve Wisconsinites' health. DHS is promoting proven local policies like heightened drinking age enforcement and tracking where drunk drivers are served their last drink, says Prevention Coordinator Mary Reina Hara-Limpopoulos.
That's what we're looking for. Those are sustainable things that the coalitions and public health departments can implement that will be there and then make a healthy community for a longer time than a one-time program.
Now that Scott has given up alcohol, he says he does things with his money he would never have dreamed of when he was drinking.
I like to give. And I don't live month to month anymore now like that. And help my daughter out with college.
He says it's hard to explain, but it's like a whole new life. Kyla Calvert-Mason, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And you can find out more from this story and look at all of our reporting from this series, High Tolerance, at WPR.org/alcohol. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.